Phone check. 1, 2, the microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2, the microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader. I read Docs and Raider. I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They know I'm out there waiting so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my descrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Rome. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MCS of the Rook. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson-Owens.
And it's the 21st of January, 2006, Saturday. What is it, Paul? A day in the life or the death of the empire? What do you say? What do you think?
So many scandals, so little time. Oh, this mic is working now. Somebody must have fixed it.
Well, yeah.
Testing. Mic check, mic check.
Okay. What's your take on this?
Well, you've been
dying or living?
Gone for a week. You have to be afraid of a wounded lion, as they say.
Well, I think there's something to that.
Flashes out the most.
As someone was saying just before he went on the air, the surest way to get an attack on Iran is for to look like the Republicans are going to do badly in the November elections.
Unless we get some more Osama tapes. They must have sent it out over the radio. It was noted that it was very poor quality. I guess they had 26 couriers between he and the Al Jazeera, and apparently one of them was a radio link, but they're making a big deal out of it. Then McClellan gets up there and says, we're going to catch him at a time of our choosing.
Yeah, isn't that
which
silly?
Apparently means that they like having him around right now, and
well,
apparently that's the way it's working out.
I think that's what they'd like you to believe. I mean, I don't really think, there are certainly people who believe that the government has Osama bin Laden on ice and will produce him at an appropriate moment. I think that's that's false. I mean, I don't think they do. And in fact, the statement that that he put out last week was rather interesting. I mean, I thought that it was strange that there wasn't more of a demand for the U.S. to take seriously the offer of a truce, which is what the burden of the statement actually was. Here's the administration busily saying we're at war. I noticed that Lindsey Graham, who's not stupid, even though he's a Republican, made a point of this in talking to Judge Alito. He tries to get the judge. He was leading the judge, leading the witness. Very
most
much
of it, most of
tried to get the judge to say that we were that 9/11 was an act of war, not a crime, because the theory of this thing on the government's part is that we are at war, and therefore the president's powers are the powers of a wartime president, etc. Now, in fact, if the U.S. wants to keep up this fiction, that it's the U.S. government wants to keep up this fiction, it's at war, then obviously an offer of a truce should be considered, but they didn't.
Well, I've heard one spin on that, which is that in the Islamic Muslim tradition, being at war is anathema to a religion of peace, and that periodically combatants are supposed to make an offer to show that they are, they're the ones who will make peace if the terms weren't really offered. So I don't.
All the more reason the administration should have taken it up and should mm-hmm. have at least talked about it and talked about this. I mean, obviously, it's a lie that the U.S. is at war. The U.S. opposition, the opposition to the U.S. from the Middle East, from Al-Qaeda insofar as it exists as an institution, and the general rejection of U.S. imperialism in the Middle East are such that the U.S. needs an excuse, so to speak, to keep on killing people. This war talk is the way to do it. But they should at least be consistent. If they're talking war and they get an offer of a truce from, quote, the other side, close quote, they should consider it. They haven't.
Well, even Churchill said jaw is better than war.
Very good. Good point.
With a cigar in his mouth, so you can hardly understand him. But the most bizarre effect of was the blurb on the Rogue State book by William Blum.
Yes.
Now, when I first saw the fact that he had been he was in the news and it went up, I thought it was merely because he was blackballed from going to Cuba. But apparently that was already issued the week before. But
you should fill in the background here and explain what happened.
Rogue State is a great book by William Blum. He's got an earlier book called Killing Hope, which is just sort of a catalog of the malfeasance of the, particularly the CIA, but not just the CIA, around the world. And
but it came up because Osama bin Laden referred to it in his statement,
particularly
referred to the book, suggested that Bush pay attention to Blum's recommendation in that book.
The Washington Post has an interview that includes comments from Sam Smith of the Progressive Review, which is quite out of the ordinary for them, and it actually talks about. In the preface, William Blum says, I would end all attacks on the U.S. by apologizing first to all of the widows and orphans around the world who, and it wasn't just men that were killed, obviously, by U.S. malfeasance, and then pledged to not interfere with other people's business. So,
and you can see why, therefore, Osama bin Laden recommended that. But Blum, I like Blum's comment. He says he's just been besieged by media ever since this. He says, it's better than being recommended by Oprah.
The Osama.
No, in fact, I think he said
Oprah.
It the other way around. I said it's almost as good as being recommended by Oprah.
True.
That's right.
But it is worth, his stuff is worth reading, and the fact that he's number
indeed.
One on Amazon.
It's extremely valuable.
It's a great great sign.
Yeah, it went from 347,000 or something to 27th and on the Amazon ranking of people who want the book. And if it leads people to read the book, that's great. It's the sort of account that, it's not just a flash in the pan in a sense there, Paul, because, people do want to know about what this war is really going on through the miasma of lies and misrepresentations we're getting from the administration. I mean, remember that Chomsky's little book of interviews, the 9/11, was the single best-selling book about 9/11 after the fact. This is not a populace that is looking for revenge against enemies of our nation the way the administration wants to wants to cut it. These are people who want to understand what's going on here and why this has happened, why we've gotten into this situation. That question was read out by the administration after 9/11 and continues to be. And we may even have some discussion about it between now and the fall elections.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Book sales are a marginal fraction of the media environment, I'm afraid. And as we were counting a couple weeks ago, there are still a large fraction of the American population that believe that Bin Laden was or Saddam Hussein was in cahoots with bin Laden and knew about the 9/11 attack and helped with it. So
people have been told that, but there are far more people who think the war is at least a terrible mistake and that the U.S. should get out. And that's important. That's what the administration is worried about. I don't think the administration is really particularly worried about the full elections, mainly because there aren't going to be any. That by that I mean that there'll be formal elections, of course, in November. But there's only of the 435 seats in the House, there may be a dozen that are really hazard. And in the Senate, the changes will at best result in a switch of one or two votes in either direction, for or against the present majority. So the Republicans, I mean, barring an absolute catastrophe of some sort, the Republicans are not at all worried about the full elections, and they intend to keep on doing what they have been doing, that is, selling the war on terrorism. Karl Rove crawled out of his hole the other day and gave a speech to Republicans saying that the subject of the election in the fall is the war on terrorism, and we have the difference between Democrats and Republicans. The Democrats think in a pre 9/11 fashion, and the Republicans think in a post 9/11 fashion. This is the same set of lies that we've been hearing all along. it's a lie on the specific point he makes, by the way, because the Democrats are busily parroting the Republican line on the war, and they're not saying anything different, with the possible exception of a few fringe figures like the Representative Murtha of Pennsylvania.
Well, I have a little different spin. I think there's a little more dissension in the ranks, and clearly the
where
in the Democratic Party, the rank and file, and there's also quite a few Conyers.
The rank and file? You mean
people out in the hinterland? You know, nobody holds party cards anymore, but people that have supported the Democrats in the past are. The natives are restless. Even the convention, that put Kerry up was not really of the mind of Kerry. So,
So what difference did that make?
But actually, I think none. Also on the point of whether they're worried about it, I think actually they are. I think that's why Rove came out a little bit. Well, I have a little thing to note in the way of a recess appointment. Did you notice this Hans von Spakovsky getting a recess appointment? He was appointed to the Federal Election Commission. Mm-hmm. He supports the government-issued identification and voting in Georgia. He was a key player in the 2000 Florida election takeover, I guess. He's a member of the Federalist Society, which believes that we aren't a democracy, but we're a republic. And I don't know. It's just he's now going to head the FEC, the Federal Election Commission. So I think they are worried enough to start fixing things like that in advance. So it was a recess appointment. Obviously, he'd have had some embarrassing questions if he'd had gone before the Senate or to get confirmed.
Well, I agree with you that they're worried about the flow of opinion in the country. That is important. There's an interview by David Barsamyan with Cindy Sheehan, and it's extremely good. I mean, Sheehan is really quite remarkable. I mean, that's strange California accent, and then what comes through it is in a just eminent sense. I mean, brilliant description of what the situation is in this country right now for an awful lot of, indeed, a growing number of people. And they're certainly worried about that. They think, the government thinks, that the fix is in as far as the election is concerned, that the a whole range of controls of safe seats, from gerrymandering to the control of election systems and whatnot, are such that they don't have to worry about being voted out in any way in the 2006 elections, that the Republicans are not going to lose control of either House of Congress. But they are certainly worried about the rising tide of opposition in the country at large, and they want to beat that back. And one of the ways they're beating that back is making sure that the Democrats are on message on the war. We can argue about fringe aspects of the war. Should we send more body armor? Should we not? But the principles about the war will not be part of the election. That's what the administration is insisting on, and that's what the Democrats are agreeing to. I mean, in witness of that last point, look at the speech that Mrs. Clinton gave in Princeton this last week. I mean, Clinton, who is probably going to be the Democratic nominee if, in 2008, produced an account of the war that was slightly to the right of the administration and called for greater belligerence towards Iran. Now, when this is what's coming from the Democratic Party, the Republicans don't need to worry. Our friend and colleague, ubiquitous Ed, was here earlier talking about a piece that James Carville, the Democrat strategist, had put out this last week, in which he said that, yes, of course, we've got to get the Democrats, Democrat president elected in 2008, and the way to do it is to wrap ourselves in the flag. And that's what Mrs. Clinton did in Princeton this week.
Well, I'm not boosting them. I'm just saying I think there's a little more more question. At least there's one seat in Texas that's probably not going to go to the Republican. DeLay will be demoted back to, well, he'll probably become a lobbyist. I guess he's probably well ensconced on K Street, or maybe he'll
that's
be
an opening now.
He'll
I mean.
Be shuffling papers in the background and be sort of behind the scenes. The other thing that Rove says, the Republicans have to champion the economy. And I clipped just the headline out of a Counterpunch article. Hourly wages have fallen in 18 of the last 20 months. So
that's important.
The economy's fine for certain classes and people who have money to play in the roulette wheel of the stock market. But and they actually think that it's the circumstances are bad for them because of onerous. Owners, things like capital gains taxes and all that, and the threat of it not being extended and all this malarkey. It seems to me that what we need is, among other things in tax reform, is a transaction tax. I forget what the acronym for it.
The Tobin tax?
Tobin tax, They actually have instituted something like that for high levels of wealth exchanges in Venezuela, curiously enough. Interesting. It's one of the only taxes increases that Chavez has actually put through. He's actually been rather mild in a lot of regards, but then he's got a lot of oil to...
but they're obviously, Venezuela is obviously doing terrible things. I mean, we were told about that by the State Department this week. The State Department pointed out that Venezuela is spending a vast amount of its budget on military affairs. This is worrisome. I mean, since this is a non-democratic state, by definition, from the U.S. State Department, even though President Chavez has won far more elections, it wouldn't be hard, than George Bush. Nevertheless, this is, by definition, a non-democratic state, and they're spending far too much on weapons. Says the State Department was busily trying to get Brazil and Spain not to sell military materials to Venezuela.
Well, that's a done deal.
So they're saying, Venezuela, with a much smaller GDP, gross domestic product, than that in the U.S., spends 1.5% under its current budget arrangements on weapons. The U.S. spends 7% of its GDP. So this is what we're getting from the State Department.
The stove calling the pot black.
I'm not even that, it seems to me that it's worse than that, that Venezuela has every reason to be worried about the descent of an American armed force on it. I mean, the U.S. tried to promote a coup and overthrow and kill the president there once in any case, now at least once we know of. The possibility of the U.S. Finding an excuse to send military to the Andean region is, I think, very great, as these elections, as socialists continue to be elected presidents in the Latin American states. The U.S., if it did not have its army tied down in Southwest Asia, would be using it in Latin America. So Venezuela has a good reason, I think, to think about its military preparedness.
And it elected in Chile. It's a pretty amazing story. Mm-hmm. Ms. Bachelot, I guess there's some French legacy.
Well, like Pinochet, too. Right.
Yeah, her father was the Allende general, I guess. So she and her family were all pretty much tortured during that era. So that's a good
sign. Apparently died in prison, her father did, and she was in exile for a while. So, yes, this is the same party that held the presidency before under Lagos, but much has been made of the fact she's the first female president, but probably more important is the fact that this is represents a continuity of the socialist or the party that of Salvador Allende in control of the Chilean government, in spite of what obviously the U.S. would like in this area. And this is part of the general phenomenons happening south of the U.S. border of center-left or social democratic governments coming to the fore. May even happen in Mexico.
What's going on in Canada, though? I thought Carville would be up there, working for the Liberals or the Conservatives, depending on who was paying him more money. But apparently he has time to write an op-ed, so he's probably not getting involved in that. It seems to be extremely volatile. People in Canada are so disgusted with the Liberal cronyism that they may go to Harper, who is basically... long cut out of the same mold that George Bush is, by Canadian standards.
I assume
he's probably not quite so true believer, free marketer, but pretty close, and by Canadian standards. So it may be another minority government, and they just may have turmoil for a while longer.
But I think you're right that the probable triumph of a conservative government in Canada is a criticism of the long liberal control of that liberal party control of that government, and a rejection, as you say, of the cronyism and the too long in place character of this present Canadian government.
Cronyism by U.S. standards.
Exactly. So, yeah,
it's pretty amazing that
these people don't know from cronyism. that's quite true. Speaking of cronyism, what do you make of the Larry Franklin case?
Well, there was a cover story on the op-ed on the Washington Post webpage, but apparently it didn't make the front page of the print edition, and it's not getting as much coverage as it needs to be. I wonder whether it'll be discussed on any of the chat shows this weekend. I'd wager that it won't.
You mean just the fact of the sentencing of Franklin?
Yeah, supposedly he's cooperating, but I don't think they're going to go up the chain of malfeasance. Anyway, but he got 10 years, which I guess is a low sentence for what he was accused of.
Yeah, 12 and a half, something like that. But yes, I think it's right. It is, and it seems pretty pro forma. I mean, the judge in what we're talking about here is the case of Larry Franklin, who was on Douglas Feith's staff in the Pentagon, and was passing documents about Iran to the Israeli government through the primary Israeli lobby in this country, AIPAC. They finally decided that this was embarrassing, that he shouldn't be doing this. The judge in the case, though, who sentenced him yesterday, said that, of course, Mr. Franklin didn't have any intention of harming the United States. He still shouldn't do that. This is secret stuff, and he's not supposed to pass it around. I mean, I'm paraphrasing what the judge said. But, of course, you know, Mr. Franklin is a nice guy who didn't have any intention of harming the U.S. Well, depending upon how you define the U.S., of course, there are many who would say he had a great deal of intention to harm the U.S. if we mean the safety and security of the majority of Americans, because what he was doing was pressing for Israeli-American action against Iran, attacks on Iran, and providing information that would be helpful in Iran and helpful to Israel and Israeli lobbyists in the U.S., notably AIPAC, to make that case to the American government. I mean, it was a round the horn play, so to speak, where he was trying to insist, trying to influence the policy of the American government in exactly the direction that his own boss, Douglas Feith, wanted it to go. So this is what the court interprets as not harming the interests of the U.S. Furthermore, they found some people to hang out to dry on this. The two AIPAC guys who have been summarily dismissed from AIPAC, and AIPAC refuses to pay their legal bills in order to insulate the lobby from the two fellows that Franklin was passing information to. These two guys will be tried, at that time, Franklin's sentence will be further reduced. It is, as you say, already on the low end of the sentencing guidelines for espionage of this sort. As someone pointed out, espionage in wartime usually means execution. So 12 and a half years is pretty light. And the 12 and a half years is totally pro forma. That is, it will be reduced down substantially when the two AIPAC guys who are going to take the heat go on trial.
Well, let's see. Pollard got life, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was under Bush 1.
And various attempts to... This is Jonathan Pollard, who was spying for Israel, and various attempts to mitigate his sentence by the Israeli government and by the Israeli lobby in this country have gone nowhere under both Republican and Democrat administrations.
Yeah, that was a big move to get Clinton to pardon him on the way out, and he decided to pardon that Swiss businessman instead.
So. And the reason was that the military, the Pentagon, said, no way. I mean, Clinton would have obviously happily have done that, being as unprincipled as he is, but he was told by the Pentagon that in no uncertain terms that this guy who was in the American, he was an American Navy man, was not to be pardoned. And, okay.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that's still an option in the Bush 2 term. I wouldn't be surprised
Bush 2 may have a lot of people to pardon. Huh?
Yeah, he's got probably a big file on that, too. He keeps picture cards of them as well, as he did the terrorists. Terrorists. That's right. You
terrorists.
Said it with two almost one syllable.
Yeah.
Yeah, but mocking him is too easy.
Mocking him is too easy, and I'm increasingly uncomfortable with doing it, Paul. I think it's really dangerous. I'm coming more and more to think that, you know, the sort of dumbness of George Bush is probably the best act that Karl Rove or whoever at the Republican Party ever came up with. I mean, they put up this guy and basically encourage him to do the sort of dumb guy routine to attract the opprobrium of upper class liberals, and at the same time the administration goes on and does what it's doing for its own constituency. I mean, we have this remarkable range of incompetence in the Bush administration that's sort of chalked up to say, well, Bush is a dumb guy. But from Iraq through the Katrina business, you're doing a great job, Brownie, to this tremendous screw-up that's going on right now over the Medicare drugs thing, what we're dealing with is not incompetence, but with an agenda. I mean, this is the Republican plan precisely to screw up these jobs, screw up Iraq in the sense that the interest in Iraq has nothing to do, of course, with a war on terrorism. Interest in Iraq has to do with the U.S. position in control of world energy resources and the vast profits to be made by American corporations in this regard. The Katrina thing, too, is not accidental incompetence. It's an attention to whose interests are being served by this administration. It's not that of poor people in New Orleans.
It's safer to make money for the Bechtels, et cetera.
Exactly.
There than in Iraq. And since we aren't going to spend any more reconstruction money in Iraq.
Exactly. we got to do it someplace.
It's
going to
be defunded.
But then this Medicare thing, I mean, this drug system is this Medicare support for, or supposes Medicare pharmaceutical program went into effect on the first of the month.
Well, it didn't go into effect for a lot of people.
Exactly. That's the point. I mean, it is incredibly badly done, and the outcry across the country is very great. But once again, this is not incompetence. This is not George Bush being a dumb guy. This is not incompetence on the part of the Bush administration. This is the agenda. This is what they want to do. Screw up this sort of thing in such a way that it redounds to the profit of the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies that are making out like bandits in this thing.
Well, they certainly are. They wrote the...
Exactly.
They wrote, the, right. wrote it, so they
they're lobbyists on K Street.
But you think they might have made it work a little smoother if they're trying to show that private enterprise can do a better job than government.
You're an optimist as usual, I mean, in thinking that they would want to do it. Look, the thing to compare it with directly is Hillary Clinton's health care plan from 1993, which was an attempt to do exactly the same thing across the board on health care. That is, establish a system that guaranteed the profits of the insurance companies and the medically interested corporation, HMOs and things like that, while by throwing a sop to folks who said, well, we need support for medical care in this country. Mm-hmm. And that was it was an incredibly complex Rube Goldberg-type device because it was, in a sense, designed to fail in the sense of giving affordable health care to people in the U.S. It was not designed to fail in terms of giving profits
to the companies. Well, there's no way to reform the health care system without, when you're subsidizing the part of it that's the problem.
Well, and what we have here under the Republicans is exactly what the Democrats wanted to do 12 years ago. This is particularly targeted to drugs, but still, you know, it's the system is precisely the same.
Well, they're fixing other parts of it, too. But it seems to me that they're so greedy, they're actually... you know, I was talking about apparently the these healthcare investment funds, I forget the acronym for it now, are going to be featured in the State of the Union address. And in the denouement of the last Congress, they threw some more money at that. And that actually undermines the existing health insurance system as per. So I think there's some of this stuff is actually very self-destructive in its own terms.
As I say, you're an optimist. I hope they'll get in their own way on this matter. But they're not going to get any real difficulty on this from anyone. So we'll see.
At the very, very storied Riverside Church, I don't know. I don't think anybody's flying out to New York that's hearing this right now. But you can find it on the web at bushcommission.org, this commission on crimes against humanity. It's going to include Dar Jamail, who's one of the few intrepid reporters on the ground in Iraq, though he's obviously out of that country and back here right now. Scott Ritter is supposed to be there. Farmer ambassador from the UK to Uzbekistan, who was featured with Amy Goodman this
yes.
week, is going to be testifying there too about what he knows of the deal with the devil in Uzbekistan. The U.S. will deal with anybody, and then he got a better deal from Russia, apparently, from Putin, so he kicked out the U.S., and they no longer have the bases in Uzbekistan. The U.S. Military no longer has the bases there, but it's going to be an interesting thing. This is the second of a series, and they have a lot of stuff up on this website, so it's... another great resource, bushcommission.org.
We mentioned that the State of the Union message, the president's speech about roughly what they have in mind, is due up at the end of the month. I don't think the date's firm yet, but one thing that is firm is the fecklessness of the Democrats. Bush has this speech coming up with the tide running against him, as we've been saying, on the war in Southwest Asia, with the saber rattling about Iran, and with this colossal screw-up on Medicare pharmaceutical bill. In spite of that, the Democrats have chosen as the responder to the Bush State of the Union address the neophyte governor of Virginia, Governor Kaine, whom nobody knows, who at his inauguration, Virginia elects their governors in the off year, at his inauguration last week gave a long speech and a bad one by some accounts. I didn't hear the speech. I read it. The burden of the speech is how the U.S. must, like Patrick Henry, the famous Virginian, stand against tyranny. And where are we going to stand against tyranny? You've got it. In Iraq and in Southwest Asia in general, he says the Middle East. In other words, the Democrats have chosen as the responder to Bush's State of the Union address a right-wing Democratic governor from a southern state who is a supporter of the war. What are they thinking, Paul?
Not much, apparently. That's the first I heard of that. Maybe that'll be subject to editing. Maybe he'll have to bow out. I thought
that would be nice.
Be ex-governor of Virginia, but then that would be too much like favoring somebody
I think that's,
for president.
I think that's part of the problem, and the Clinton people wouldn't be at all happy with that because the retiring governor of Virginia is a Democratic possibility for president. The Amnesty International has got an interesting campaign going that I hope gets the publicity it deserves. It is a drive to demand that Bush tell, quote, the truth about torture, close quote, in the State of the Union address. This is important, and I hope Amnesty International is able to get this campaign going.
Human Rights Watch this week issued a report about U.S. torture. And I think I don't know if it was their annual report or whether this is a focused report. I haven't gone to the direct report yet, but their thesis is, again, torture and mistreatment have become a deliberate part of the Bush administration
yep.
counterterrorism strategy. And of course, since that was the gist of the sidebar comments to the McCain amendment that barred inhumane and torturous treatment, it's pretty clear. It's almost an announcement that it is still policy. And they're trying to make it, Cheney a couple weeks ago said that if we'd had this, that was about the, that wasn't about torturing, that was about the eavesdropping, right? If we'd had the eavesdropping plan in place, we may have avoided 911.
But the arguments are similar, right, in that the Justice Department this week under the redoubtable Alberto Gonzalez came out with a brief about how what the president is doing in these areas. I remember Gonzalez was the man who called the Geneva Conventions quaint and wrote these memos that established part of the torture policy that the U.S. has been following to the outrage of the rest of the world. Gonzalez's Justice Department this week produced a brief about how the president is acting at the zenith of his powers in wartime, and therefore all these things that people have been upset about, like torture and eavesdropping on American citizens, they're really okay. And indeed, Gonzalez is supposed to appear before the Congress next week to talk about those things, which might be quite a show if he really tries to do it.
Watching a bit of that. I'm looking for which Democratic senator will point out to him that Gonzalez has said both, we think the authorization that allowed the attack on Afghanistan authorized this because it was tantamount to calling for a war, worldwide war. And also having said, we didn't bring it to the Congress because we didn't think they would pass it.
Exactly.
So display of cognitive dissonance that is befitting a Bush administration.
Well,
acolyte, I guess.
Once again, the question is, will they be able to get away with it? I mean, the Conyers censure resolution languishes in the House. The Democrats can't even get rooms. Those few Democrats who want to do it can't even get room to have a hearing on this matter. There's certainly no indication that, in spite of the fact that large number of Americans think that Bush should be impeached if he lied to the American people on any of these issues, there is absolutely no movement in that sort in the Congress or in the Democratic Party. Did you hear, by the way, I think the Bush administration might be worried. Did you hear that a whale swam up the River Thames and swallowed Tony Blair? I mean, Bush might be worried.
Blair's feeling a little beached. There's been a release
exactly.
of another memo, and the memo has to do with his foreknowledge of rendition.
Exactly.
We were joking a while back when they were talking about the secret prisons in Eastern Europe that they might disqualify Poland from voting in the EU. Well,
right.
maybe the UK should be disqualified
that would
from
be
voting in
wouldn't
the
that
EU
be something?
For malfeasance in high places.
Well, he might just get the French and the Germans, to think that that might be something to do. I was actually rather pleased to see the new German government, which is supposed to be a center-right government, remember? The new German government not only called for the closing of Guantanamo before the visit of the new German chancellor to Washington, the German foreign minister this week says that there, under no circumstances should there be an attack on Iran. Now, this, as I say, from a generally conservative German government, but that seems to me to be fairly important, particularly since the French were at the same time busily saying that they'd nuke anybody who crossed them on terrorist issues. So
Merkel,
very
even
strange.
Merkel, the prime minister, chancellor, even brought it up when she was standing next to Bush, or maybe
isn't that
it was
interesting?
Brought up by a reporter, but
she'd said it just before she got there.
Yeah,
right.
So the funny thing about that interaction was Bush's going quack quack with her, saying, "We both were sort of elected in kind of odd circumstances," or something. I don't know. I can't remember the exact.
They didn't have big majorities.
Can't
yes.
even paraphrase it
right.
well.
Yes.
As far as having political capital, he's.
Right.
Apparently his capital has dwindled, and he's acknowledging it now, but not very often in his actions.
How do you read the administration and even more the Democrats rattling the sabers about Iran? They're having just a wonderful time doing it, obviously. I mean, Paul, I can't think. it certainly is true that if circumstances really got extremely bad, if it looked like there was going to be an earthquake in the electorate and Republicans would lose badly in the fall, certainly this administration would attack Iran in order to produce an emergency. I mean, that's not out of the question that they would do that sort of thing.
There are other emergencies,
but
they
short
could choose,
of that,
though, too.
Exactly, exactly. And and since the madness of attacking Iran is patent, I mean, surely they're not going to do it. They are. This is all fuss, and that they are just talking this way. And so, in part, so Hillary Clinton can say the administration is not being tough enough on Iran. They're doing. This is all a shadow play. They're all making faces when they don't intend to do anything at all about it. Don't you think?
$68 oil seems to be what deflated the market yesterday, and the idea of Iran causing an oil shock,
right,
is sobers people. I guess I'm going to get a little more than a little controversial here. I'm not going to be an apologist for Ahmadinejad, but I think there have been some peculiar translations and peculiar manipulation of the things he's purportedly said. I kind of regard him as kind of a little more intelligent Pat Robertson in the way he's been talking. But even on the Liar Hour with Lair sitting down and with the president, I'm sure that you can go to their website and find that archived pretty clearly. Lair even points out that the remarks about the Holocaust being a myth were modified afterwards by the foreign minister. And if you look at the other kinds of things Ahmadinejad has said, he's clearly acknowledging there was a crime against the European Jewry, because he says things like, well, they should have settled them somewhere in European territory if they are the perpetrators of it. Mm-hmm. He said something like, they moved them to the Middle East because they wanted, the Europeans are finishing off the Holocaust by putting them here. I mean, which are, pretty crazed remarks, but they don't indicate that he's a denier of a crime in Europe. He's just saying, why does the crime have to be extended to displacing another people, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it's an interesting problem that the president of Iran offers to the U.S. and the U.K. on this matter, when he starts making comments about Israel and about the foundation of Israel and whatnot, because there's a certain awkwardness on the part of the U.S. and the U.K. to suggest that the real reason for their war in the Middle East is the defense of Israel. The U.S. doesn't really want to be caught in that position in the Middle East, and therefore its response to these comments, while it made some headlines, has been relatively temperate. What the U.S. is really concerned about, and the way they're really spinning the propaganda, is over the nuclear issue. They're saying we can't allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon. Now, we've heard this song before. It killed, hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq. But this is the line, and of course it's the line of the Clintons and the Obamas, as well as of the Bushes and the Roves. This is the line that they want to sell, and there is a general agreement about it, but it also seems that the bark is worse than the bite, that they really cannot consciously be planning to attack Iran or allowing the Israelis to do it. It's mad.
It's boggling. I looked at William Arkin's piece, and he has sort of a blog in the Washington Post, and he's well connected with the military. He has the book out, Code Names, and he's arguing that it isn't a possibility. But he cites McCaffrey being on the cable this week saying, well, if we're really going to wipe out their nuclear program, we're going to have to use nukes ourselves.
Yep.
So the saber rattling is going on.
Oh, indeed,
and
it is.
And to my mind, the fact that logic dictates otherwise doesn't mean that this administration couldn't get in the position, even barring the worry of an electoral loss, that things spin out of control rhetorically and eventually lead to some kind of nominal attack, if nothing else, just to show that they're not just swashing the buckle or something.
And of course, and the fact that they are talking more than they plan to act is not lost on the thoroughly unprincipled Hillary Clinton, who attacks the Bush administration for not doing enough against Iran in a speech this week.
Well, one of her lines was something that I can qualifiedly agree with, is that we've been farming out our foreign policy. The fact that we don't acknowledge Iran, you know, do we have a Swiss interest section that acts on our behalf in Cuba? I mean, it's ridiculous to not have direct communication. I mean, and I don't think
would that help? I mean,
well, it could. I mean, it's not having it at all certainly is a big impediment to.
Well, they can discuss these things at the in the Security Council, Paul, because the presidency of the Security Council will be in the hands of John Bolton when these matters come before the.
I think that is the timing they had outlined, and that's the kind of thing that could lead to that kind of escalation, and that's why I'm still worried about it, despite the fact that all the indicators are that it would not even be a NATO attack, which was dreamt of not so very long ago by Bolton and crew, since the UN certainly wasn't going.
But look at what's happening elsewhere in the region. I mean, the U.S. Blows away a couple of families in the back of beyond in Pakistan and says, we were after Al-Qaeda's number two.
Well, actually, what they're saying is we don't know about I heard a guy talk about the alleged attack last night on.
Yeah.
They're not even acknowledging that the attack happened at this point, much less that they had anything to do with it.
But what's interesting is that Pakistan has not only made the government of Pakistan has not only made a pro forma objection to the U.S. Essentially doing terrorist bombing in Pakistan. They have said categorically that there are to be no more such bombings. Now that was they didn't have to go the extra mile there. I mean, Pakistan. The Pakistani government, if it was on message, if it was following the script the U.S. had given it, it might have said, "Oh, gee, you shouldn't have done that," and then gone back to say, "Of course, we have to fight terrorism, et cetera, et cetera." No, they didn't. They said there are to be no more such actions in Pakistan. That's quite remarkable.
Hmm. Well, the intensity of the antagonism throughout. I mean, being a military dictator doesn't make it all work for Musharraf. I mean, he has to watch his back fairly closely.
I gotta say, it does express what the government of Pakistan as a whole thinks about this matter, and that's surprising. They are not on the reservation as far as the U.S. is concerned. And this is happening, of course, what this suggests is that it would not be all that easy for the U.S. to carry out the attack on Iran, and that's why people like the war criminal McCaffrey are saying that any attack would have to be nuclear.
To so many scandals, so little time. There's a lot of stuff. I'd like to renew my call for people to write Barack Obama and ask him to announce dramatically that he's going to oppose Alito and filibuster it
what
as
a,
well.
What a fake liberal he is.
Well, you got to call him to
all right, let's watch this, Paul. Here's a good test of the fake liberalism of Barack Obama. His colleague, Senator Durbin, has said that he will vote against Alito and has suggested now that a filibuster against Alito is possible. We're waiting for Barack Obama to say either one of those things.
We shouldn't just wait. We should contact him and tell him what we think.
But what do you think there's a snowball's chance in hell of Obama supporting a filibuster against Alito?
If his senior senator does, and if other pivotal people do, and if his constituency rises up. The most affecting testimony in the Alito hearings, I thought, was the last day with the African-American people intervening. This guy from the South.
But Obama has not said he will even vote against him. But Durbin at least has said he'll vote against Alito.
Well, he would defer to the senior senator.
Oh, he wouldn't.
First.
No, that has nothing to do with it.
There's no way he's not going to vote against him, but he voted against Roberts.
Look, I'm not sure. He voted for Rice twice. Come on. There's every possibility that Obama will vote for Alito.
I think
he will vote against
that,
him. I think he'll vote against him. But he won't vote against him in an effective fashion.
Right.
To vote against him in an effective fashion, you would have to support a filibuster.
Right, exactly.
The only way they can stop him, Obama won't do that. He will go along. He will go along to the point of saying, "All right, I'll vote with the Democrats, but I won't support a filibuster."
My understanding that the nuclear option is really extra rules, because the rules of the Senate is you need 2/3 majority to change the rules. So the fact that they could change the rules without a 2/3 majority is based on a ruling of Cheney is actually flaunting the Senate's storied history, as it were, and their protocol.
Parliamentarily, I don't think it's difficult. I mean, Cheney in the chair would simply rule that a simple majority is necessary. The ruling of the chair would be appealed, and that would be decided on the basis of a simple majority. So, I mean, it's there's no parliamentary barrier to do.
There is a changing the rule.
Now, wait a minute. The point is that the decision on the rule is taken by the chair, and if the chair is the Vice President of the United States, as President of the Senate, making that ruling, then if the ruling is wrong, the way to correct that is to appeal the decision of the chair to the House, or to the Senate, and that vote on an appeal decision of the chair is by majority.
But my understanding is that if that's regarded as a rule of the Senate, it needs a two-thirds majority to change it.
Well, I don't think that's true. I think what would happen, I just described it, seems to me the way that it's been set up about how the nuclear option, as it's been talked about, would take effect, but the opposition comes from where you say it comes from. That is the traditions of the Senate, and there are a lot of senators who would say that the a decision like that, however parliamentarily accurate it would be, would fly in the face of this tradition of the Senate, and therefore would object to it. They might not even get their majority on appealing the decision of the chair. I doubt that, though.
There's so much more to be said. I want to ask the personal prerogative to mention the fall of another journalist who was taking money from Monsanto. That great corporation wants to change all of our genetic material. And the reason I want to bring it up is because Michael Fumento is the journalist in question, and he grew up studied here. He was part of the Orange and Blue Observer, the conservative rag, which has money from the Dartmouth Institute and continues on to this day, and wrote for the News Gazette regularly and was an occasional op-ed person. He got a job with the Scripps Howard News Service. Didn't reveal that he got $60,000 from Monsanto to write a book called Bioevolution, which is very pro-biotech, and he didn't reveal that to the people he was working for at Scripps Howard News Service, and he's lost his job. But to the rescue, a conservative institute, the Hudson Institute, has kept him on, and which is where he'll be working next to Libby. So it's a bit of a refuge for the indicted and the exposed.
Maybe they can share a set of handcuffs or something.
Yeah. So I think it's great that he was a very, I don't know, the Orange and Blue Observer caliber of journalist even in his later days. He was the one who was saying heterosexual transmission of AIDS wasn't possible for the longest time, which is clearly untrue.
Talking about reporters, the story of the Christian Science Monitor reporter Jill Carroll taken hostage in Iraq awaits resolution at the moment. Once again, I'm shocked at the inaction of the administration. The people who are holding Jill Carroll are saying that she's being held hostage until the release of female prisoners held by the U.S. in Iraq. There are various descriptions of this, but the number is less than a dozen. Instead of responding to this, instead of doing what they should do and release the female prisoners, the administration has done nothing. They're perfectly happy with the circumstances that Ms. Yeah. Carroll finds herself in. I think this is quite shocking, Paul. I mean, that the administration does not, I mean, it's like, on a much larger scale, it's like not taking seriously Osama bin Laden's description of a truce. I mean, the unwillingness of the U.S. to deal with the people it would prefer to kill in Iraq is, once again, I think not incompetence, but agenda. This is what they're doing all along, but here we have it in a particularly brutal example, the example of this woman being held hostage.
My understanding is only three actually in direct American custody, and they could negotiate something where they would release them to Iraqi custody as an interim basis or something like that.
Yeah. But they could do something, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that wouldn't be anything like contemplating negotiating with Al-Qaeda.
Well, which they're doing anyhow, as we well know. I mean, they're negotiating every chance they get. They're negotiating with anyone who will talk to them. The U.S., while saying we don't negotiate with terrorists, is, of course, negotiating with anybody who will talk to them in Iraq, because the U.S. is so anxious to get its troops out of Iraq before the fall election. Yeah. The U.S. apparently is talking to members of the Arab League. This was what Cheney's visit was about, to replace American troops with Arab League troops and to get that done by the fall before the election.
In the category of manipulation of the media and journalism, I wanted to mention the little piece on Richard Scrushy paying money for favorable coverage in the area where his trial happened. Mm-hmm. And now the newspaper, some of the people are saying they're still owed $150,000. So he's actually welching on his payments for favorable coverage. Apparently, it's unethical to have someone to write stories and get a paper to print them while the court is in session. But it doesn't violate any laws. So.
That's correct. That.
Maybe they can get them on income tax violations on that.
No one. Controlling legal authority, in the words of Al Gore. Yeah. The bit of war news that I thought was important in this last week or so, Paul, last 2 weeks, is that it seems clear that the resistance in Iraq is finding ways to shoot down American helicopters. Several large American helicopters have crashed. And one case, apparently, the U.S. government has said, yes, indeed, it was brought down by a surface-to-air missile. But there are at least three incidents like this. Yeah. Perhaps more.
Two of them are two-seater observation helicopters, and there was one Black Hawk involved.
I think one was a Black Hawk, one was an Apache helicopter, and so these are fairly large items that the U.S. is losing, and apparently losing to sort of an airborne version of the improvised explosive device. So what's going on? There seems to have been a tick up in the lethality of the resistance. The U.S. Continues to make a complete hash of what it's doing in Iraq and is desperately looking for ways out. We'll probably hear a little about
that. Blame that on Iran, too, I suppose. Devices came
a little
from
of that completely spun in the State of the Union address.
If there's anything they can do to increase the violence in Iraq, it would be attacking Iran because of what we've talked about before, the Badr Brigade. But it would also ensure that any, even a secular government, if it would ever rise in Iran, would be even more more convinced that they would need nuclear weapons. It's wrongheaded from every point of view. But
it's obvious any government in Iran would see the necessity for a nuclear deterrent. Just look at a map. I mean, it's surrounded by nuclear states, most of them the U.S. or the U.S. clients, Israel, Pakistan, and so forth. It would be irresponsible for any Iranian government not to press towards the possession of a nuclear deterrent. We say the nuclear deterrent worked for a generation between the U.S. and the USSR. Iran has seen very clearly what happens to countries that don't have weapons of mass destruction across the border in Iraq, and what happens to countries that do have them in the case of North Korea. So the Iranian case seems to me to be open and shut. Of course they should be looking for a nuclear weapon.
Do you hear some legal pundits, including this John Yoo guy, saying that the resolution of the expulsion of Iraq from Kuwait allowed for this attack, that it was included, which is total balderdash. But what what nobody talks about is the other provisions of that UN resolutions that call for the efforts to demilitarize the entire region. Well, the U.S. isn't on board for that either. So
we're out of here. News from Neptune. Inshallah, with you next week.